This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, your pop culture home.
Yeah, Frank here has got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
Billiard room.
No, not billiard. Not the billiards. It was...
Billiards room.
Come on already. Come on. We call it the...
The place to be.
The place to be. Yes, the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me sad aside and smiling, so...
That's what she said!
Why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be Podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
D'Lo Brown interfered with a frog splash and hit it on Severin, getting some revenge.
I know.
What the hell was it? What was that laugh? It was like an old cartoon fucking Hanna-Barbera dog or something. It was like Snidely? Was that the fucking dog that laughed like that?
JR's got a little more time than I do to sit and actually write a whole show.
This is the third time you said it to me today now. I'm really curious.
Well, I'm not saying that you have nothing to do. I'm just saying that your day...
I'm curious how I have more free time than
no,
you.
No, I'm going to...
What does that mean?
I don't know.
I know it's been a rough, and I know you said this long, grueling podcast schedule.
Oh, for fuck's sakes. Are you guys just joking off for the next hour?
Come on, did you say D'Amato, late 20s, 30s?
Was being...
And you included yourself in that as well?
I was being nice to him. I am still technically in my 30s.
I think they might hit a shock wall.
What the fuck is a shock wall? is that the Shockmaster's wall? He's going to fall through the shock wall.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. PTB Nation, let me know what
your opener.
To do worse than Josh Richard. Flames, mouse switch to screens, some hot dames. Tonight's audience received mid-screen video games and 15 seconds of fame. Pitiful lames, it's just a shame. Zoning, competing for the same prime time slot as Conan. No dummy at Chigawa. Announcement, free lunch journey stunt who lets me flower in the shower for an hour. The kid's supposed to be asleep. Balls to join the Sound Like Roadrunner. Beep, beep. Later this week, Big Ben Klingon. After him, there's no one else we could afford to bring on. Keep it ghetto and let him know BYOB from the get-go. I'd like to propose a toast to the grocer's host. Space holes, coast to coast.
Place to Be Nation. Welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be Podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming at you live here on this Wednesday evening inside the PTB Man Cave. Fall is here. Chilly nip is in the air. Smell the napalm coming over from Gil's house next door. And we are ready to rock and roll, so we have a great episode lined up for you here tonight. First, though, let me bring in my PIC, the Honorable Mr. Scott Criscola. Scott, how are you?
Good evening, JR. It's always a pleasure to be with you twice a week. And welcome, PTB Nation, to episode 262 of the Place to Be Podcast. It is a bit brisk on this Wednesday, but I feel like fall hasn't totally kicked in yet. You know, sometimes during the day, you still get that kind of tinge. I don't know about up in your neck of the woods. Usually it's slightly cooler where you are from where I am, but... I feel like the humidity hasn't totally went away yet, you know? Like, days in the... I want the days to be in the 60s, not the nights to be in the 60s. You know what I mean? Like, I want a little more of a chill, but...
Reminds me of the tagline of our old friend, Summer Love.
Yes! God, I miss her! I miss her drunken rants at 9:15 at night. Oh, boy. Welcome, PTB Nation. Always good to have you with us as well. How are you on this Wednesday, JR?
Doing just fine and extra fine, mm-hmm. actually, because of our guest tonight.
Oh, it's always great to
right
have
on cue. This is, I feel this has been the least maintenance that we've had to do with
I know. With I know.
I asked him. He said yes. I confirmed. He said yes. He's yes. ready. He's already ready to go, and it's yep. right perfectly aligned with where we are in our review. So yep. Before we bring him in, though, let's just quickly yep. hit up the last 2 days on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Very busy.
Scott, the reviews are back.
They are.
Judgment Day 08 up for your reading enjoyment on PlaceToBeNation.com right now. You can check that out. The old school Scott and Justin pay-per-view style review that you all have come to know and love. Of course, with the fun facts and all the other match opinions and grades all there for you. New episodes of the Great Titans of Wrestling with, of course, Parv and Kelly. Actually, I'm sorry, Parv actually stepped aside in this episode. Kelly hosted because they examined late 70s Portland.
Wow, Don Owen years.
Yes, very interesting territory there. Yes. So be sure to check that out. Titans of Wrestling number 7, looking mm-hmm. at Portland Wrestling. Off the Top Rope number 34, Mike and Rex look at Survivor Series 90. Talked about a little current WWE as well. Andrew Reich, the basketball maven of PlaceToBeNation.com. This guy belongs on like Hoops Hype or Grantland, and we got him here. Just great at analyzing and breaking down the sport of basketball, and he is doing a division-by-division preview heading into opening tip night next week. And we have, I'm sorry, is it 2 weeks or October 29th?
29th.
I'm like a week ahead this month. I keep thinking like next week's the last
week. It's the 29th.
All right, so 2 weeks. And he is previewing the Pacific Division. That is up right now with your Lakers and the Clippers and Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
Kings of Todd Weber.
That's right.
And the depleted Phoenix Suns. So you can read his full division preview on the Pacific, and then day by day we'll be having more go up as well. So if you're a Hoops fan, check it out. The Caliber Winfield Super Terrific Happy Hour Episode 3 is posted. Takes a look at Jason from... why am I drawing a blank? Quick.
Jason. Friday 13th?
Yes. Part 6, 7, and 8. Thank you. Mm-hmm. You know me, I'm a big horror buff. Richard the Mailman Episode 11... if you haven't listened to Richard the Mailman, this may be a good one to jump in on, because it is a palooza of different topics. And that includes bitching about Columbus Day and Christopher Columbus, which is good. War and Peace, not returning Bowered items out of spite, party buses, pub crawls, zombies. And Josh has a very interesting story about the Red Sox game and a sexual act that he was performing during it that may have led to their comeback. So check that out. If you're into weird shit. So it's an interesting episode, and they are a barrel of laughs.
Yes.
Lita Clark broke some news. The refurbished 3DS for Nintendo had a price drop. She's all over it. Got that for you.
Yep.
Grapple Talk Newswire, October 14th special. UFC 166 by Callum Leslie. That's there. Josh's review of Once Upon a Time this episode. Lions of Liberty, Scott. Mark Clare interviewed Christopher Robin Zimmerman about running for mayor of Minneapolis. Our good friend CRZ visited with Mark. That podcast is up. But we have another one coming from Mark this week. I believe it's going to be up on Thursday. He interviewed Kane, Scott.
Yeah.
Glenn Jacobs, Mark Clare interviewed about his political views, that he was going to run for office. And that's a pretty big get for Mark. So that's really cool. And we're going to have that housed right on PlaceToBeNation.com. Mark Clare's interview with Kane. Kings of Sport, their new podcast is up. And, of course, your Raw review as well. Plus all the other great pieces and all the other great articles. We have some good stuff coming tomorrow. It's too, of course, Hard Traveling Fanboys. Chad's piece breaking down our draft, our pay-per-view draft. That'll be up tomorrow, as well as the continuation of Risha's NBA preview. So PlaceToBeNation.com, please come support us. You can click the Amazon link on the right-hand side, and you can do that. You can order Graham Cawthon's Awesome History of WWE book, and you can also buy anything else you want, and we'll get a little bit of credit. If you also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/placetobenation, and on Twitter, place2bnation. So you can join us there all over, taking over the world, Place to Be Nation. Scott, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we will have our special guest with us.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What I'd like to have right now.
Chad, do you ever feel that the world revolves around WWF?
I think you mean WWE there, Barf.
Yeah, whatever, but what about David Crockett?
He likes it!
Well, what about Jimmy Valiant?
I'm gonna get y'all until I get you, Paul Jones. Ooh.
The Four Horsemen.
We are a family, and we are the best!
The Omni, the Dangerous Alliance.
Please welcome the newest members of the Dangerous Alliance, Arn Anderson and Larry Zbysko.
Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express.
The Fantastics are putting the U.S. Tag Team title on the line against the Midnight Express.
Main events with actual work rate in them.
Woo! 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 All right!
It's just not fair to Flair.
It's not fair for Flair.
If this is what you're looking for, please check out Where the Big Boys Play podcast, the only pure NWA and WCW supercard podcast out there.
While you were in Hollywood making movies, Thunderlips, I was winning world titles.
Well, there they are, our good friends Chad and Parr, Where the Big Boys Play. Now, if you want nonstop old school NWA discussion, getting back to that very first Starrcade, these guys have it covered. Even the PICs have made an appearance once. We are very particular what podcasts we visit. So check out our friends Chad and Parr, Where the Big Boys Play. Their link is right on our site, placetobenation.com. Just go into the podcast menu. And there they are, the other great shows we partner with. Chad and Parr, working Where the Big Boys Play. Speaking of Place to Be Nation, that's your everyday home for your pop culture needs. At placetobenation.com, we have everything. Wrestling, sports, comics, even polls. We want your opinions as well. Every day, there's something different with our top staff of writers who are experts in all fields of pop culture. from the weekly Raw review to the return of the hack. We've got everything you need. We're also working with a myriad of great podcasts. Of course, besides Chad and Parf, we have Grapple Talk, the fans podcast Off the Top Rope, Answering the 10 Count, We Found New Music, and the Kings of Sport with Nate Milton. We've got everything for your listening pleasure. So check us out every day of the week at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Now, don't forget about our good friend Graham Cawthon and the history of WWE.com. He's still the top source for all argument solvers, from match results to house show cards to pay-per-view histories. Any questions you need answered, any debates among wrestling fans that need ending, head over to Graham's treasure trove of information. You will certainly find it. Need to know what the opener of Starrcade 1995 was? What was the main event of that 1988 Boston Garden house show you went to when you were 11 years old? Graham can tell you. He has WWE, WCW, ECW results, and the growing results in TNA and Ring of Honor. So for all your wrestling research needs, check out Graham Cawthon at thehistoryofwwe.com. Now finally, if you want a place to just hang out, discuss all things wrestling with fellow diehard fans, check out the news and the great forums at twfnews.com. They have all the up-to-the-minute stories in WWE, TNA, and pretty much everywhere in between. They talk old school, Attitude Era, and even those hard-to-remember guys and shows like Waylon Mercy or In Your House Number 3. So check out all there is to see right on twfnews.com.
This is J.J. Dillon, the leader of the Four Horsemen, and you're listening to Place to Be Podcast.
All right, Scott, we're back from break, and it is time to bring in our very special guest. He is here about once every other month, and he's on the official Place to Be Nation computer that's in his basement.
Right.
That computer sanctuary. We sent it to him. It's set up in the basement just for these podcasts. And that is, of course, the great, the one and only voice of Ring of Honor, Mr. Kevin Kelly. Kevin, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot. First of all, this computer that you sent me, first of all the directions were in Mandarin Chinese, okay? And I don't speak Mandarin.
You're a broadcast journalist. You should.
You never managed Kill a Con?
Mandarin. Listen, I don't have time for this. So I'm back on the good old-fashioned landline, the way God intended it.
And Scott even called the operator first to get a hold of you.
He said, exactly.
He said, give me Kevin Kelly.
Yes.
I said, okay, let me patch
turn
it through.
Turn the crank on the phone on my wall and went right
there. Turning the crank. So, even my young son is down here staring at me. He's like, why is this in Mandarin? And he cried. So sad.
Place to be Nation at its best.
Yeah.
All right, speaking of at its best, Kevin Kelly, let's first talk about Ring of Honor before we get into the old school WWF stuff. Tournament has wrapped up. You know, we have now moved back into regular television action, but let's take a minute to kind of recap the tournament. Adam Cole is the new Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Champion, defeated Michael Elgin in a great finale. And, of course, before that, we had a very good Elgin and Steen slugfest. What were your thoughts? Who do you think stood out the most in the tournament besides the obvious, you know, Cole and Elgin? Was there anyone that you kind of thought impressed you and anyone who maybe didn't really deliver what you expected?
Well, I was, you know, let's start with the positive. Certainly, I think in terms of the two guys that really stood out to me in their losses were Machine Gun Carl Anderson and Kevin Steen. So Steen, I wondered how motivated he was. Whenever you lose a title, do you still have it in you to go back and get it again? He proved to me he still does. And Anderson, I rave about every time I see him. So the more I could see a Machine Gun in Ring of Honor, the happier I would be. And, you know, I don't know. I don't want to say anybody did badly, but I didn't think Brian Kendrick had the right strategy in his first round match.
Mm-hmm.
And was kind of disappointed with Michael Bennett.
Yeah.
Expected more out of him and didn't see it. That's not to say we won't see it. I'm still very high on him. I'm buying instead of selling. But, you know, I would have liked to have seen him go further, even though he did win.
Any thoughts on Cole's? You had a great line. I included it in the review when Cole kind of tarnished his win by attacking Jay Briscoe and attacking Michael Elgin after. I thought that was one of your probably kind of signature, will become one of your signature lines as part of Ring of Honor. Thoughts on that, where that's headed?
When I saw it, when it unfolded, it's just one of those things that comes to you, you know? And that was the one thing I could just think of, is that it was a treacherous act in the midst of all of this glory and celebration for him to do what he did at that particular time. I think it will forever cast that light on his championship reign, however long it will be. He will be either haunted or celebrated because of what he did. Some people have said that it was the best thing that Adam Cole could have ever done by super kicking Jay Briscoe and smashing Elgin in the face. We know where he stands. There's no more hiding in the shadows. He is who he is. It's freeing. It's cathartic. But then immediately you get put on the chase, and I watched Shawn Michaels get beat to holy hell when he was the world champion, weighing the exact same weight that Adam Cole weighs. So it is much harder than Adam Cole thinks to be a world champion, physically different. You get the guy's best every single night. I've learned a lot about what it's like to be world champion by sitting with Nigel for all this time. So Cole has tens of millions of dollars of wrestling talent, but did he seal his own fate to a short title reign? I guess we'll only find out over time. Jumping back in with Champions versus All-Stars on October 26th in Chicago as we sneak in a cheap plug.
Yes.
And tickets are on sale at ROHWrestling.com.
And our friend of Place of the Nation, one of our staff members, big Ring of Honor fan, Steve Willie, will be in the house in Chicago. And also, he's joining us in Pittsburgh. He's flying down from out in Wisconsin where he lives. So
I think Pittsburgh is going to be a special event for Ring of Honor.
Oh, we can't wait. We are all jazzed up for that show.
I got the feeling, so.
One last person I want to talk about, because it's someone I've been very hard on in my reviews, and I give him a tough time, but I want to give him props where needed, and that is Matt Taven. I thought had his best match that I've seen to date on this past week's TV with Jay Lethal. Beat him clean in the middle of the ring, and I thought having Truth in the Hoopla Hotties away from ringside helped him. It kind of gave him a chance to have to stand on his own and really deliver a match, and like I said in the review, if you can't have a good match with Lethal, then you may be in trouble, and I thought he delivered. Do you agree?
I completely agree. Taven's been a changed man. I wrote an article about the champions, the four men on the champion side for Champions versus All-Stars, and I highlighted somewhere along the way the switch came on for Taven.
Mm-hmm.
Was it when I knocked him and he fired back at me in commentary? That was the first time I had seen him fire up at anybody, and he stood up for himself. And then he basically, every time the title's on the line, he has a much better match than when the title's not on the line. It's so funny. Like, non-title matches, he's in trouble. But with the title up for grabs, he's been just huge money. And this match with Lethal, without any distraction, without any interference, without any help, he really stood out as a star instead of being... He was the puncher instead of the counterpuncher. And a lot of times in wrestling, it's easy to counterpunch because you let your opponent dictate the pace. But Taven set the pace.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt right. It didn't feel like, he shouldn't be driving the car. It was a good position for him to be in. And Lethal was the counterpuncher. And eventually Taven gets the victory and gets the celebration, and kudos to him. He's really coming into his own.
Yeah, I enjoyed the match. I enjoyed the whole week of TV. It was I really liked the tournament, but it almost felt kind of refreshing to get back to the old TV format. A few more matches, a little bit shorter matches, not as heavy, and some more kind of focusing on character development and different feuds. I thought it was good to kind of get that mix back on TV.
I agree.
Also, one last team I want to talk about, the debut of Outlaw Inc., Homicide and Kingston. Some creepy stuff going on, Kevin.
They scare me.
They're an odd team. It had a little bit of a gangsta feel from old ECW.
Yeah, it's a, I don't necessarily agree with the decision to have those guys in. But they're very talented individuals, and we'll see how collectively they are, how well they unify in the ring. I have my doubts as to whether or not they're going to play by the rules and make nice. You know, they wear suits backstage, they shake hands, and then they get in the ring and they scare the hell out of me. Kingston, I think, has taken a shine to me, though. I'm not going to lie. I think he's fancy on me.
Is that better or worse?
Well, it's absolutely horrible. I have sleepless nights now. But I try to say it with a smile on my face, trying to make the best of, you know, but this is not going to end well for me, I can tell you.
Well, I noticed that you did drop in that Prince Nana brought these guys in, so I'm wondering if see where that goes.
He brought him in.
Right. I'm guessing there's a reason behind you saying that, though. You usually don't say things for no reason, so I'm curious to see where
it leads to. Listen, I'm not throwing him under the bus, but under the bus he goes for this one.
Okay. One more great line you had, and I want you to use this line again tonight for me on Scott, and you called R.D. Evans a cape-wearing buffoon. Now, just picture Scott walking into the arena with Triple H's old robe on. Can you please call him the same?
Oh, Scott is definitely a cape-wearing buffoon.
Love it. All right. There's your Ring of Honor update with Kevin Kelly, and of course you can catch him and the Ring of Honor crew each and every week. Just check your local TV listings on all the Sinclair brand networks and also for live events. And now we head way back when, just about 13 years ago,
when this computer was built.
Yes, when the computer was built. When Scott was a spry 52. We head back to the second half of 2000 in the World Wrestling Federation. And we left off last time right after King of the Ring. And now we're into July. So, Scott, why don't you kick us off with the first question on our list and we'll get going.
Okay. So, Kev, the decision was made mid-year to have Shawn Michaels step down as the on-air commissioner of the company. And in came Mick Foley. What do you think the decision was behind that?
I would say it was 100% personal for Sean. So there was a lot of debate as to whether or not Sean was 100% with it all the time. And there were some that believed he needed to go away. And he did. He needed to go home and get his head on. I think that all culminated in Detroit. But again, there were so many episodes where Sean was not in his right mind and needed to be sent home. I might be confusing it with the four or five others. But I seem to remember this one in particular.
So, was there always a plan to bring Foley back in some kind of role like this, or was that only because, hey, we need someone, let's call Mick?
I think it was a little bit of both. Let's find the right role for Mick. And then, you know, when plans changed with Sean, for whatever reason, then it was, okay, now we have the idea for Mick. This works perfectly. That's the good thing when you've got, you know, kind of those legacy talents that you can always rely on. Let's go out and let's throw a rope around Mick and bring him back in, and we can have him be X, you know, kind of what, like John Layfield as commentator, same type of thing, mm-hmm. you know. He could have been mouthpiece. He could have been, you know, general manager. He could be commentator. It works great when you have those types of talents.
And I liked Foley as commissioner better than Sean, only because Sean just wasn't really around that much, and having Foley added a lot to the shows, I thought.
He's so much fun and, you know, great in pre-tapes, and everybody enjoyed working with him. And, you know, I think it was much more natural fit for him to be in that role at that time.
Kev, was Sean, like, showing up? I mean, we know the infamous time later on in the following year, but was Sean, like, was there inklings that he wasn't all there? Like, was
when
he showing up?
When you say the famous time the year later, when was that?
That was right before WrestleMania 17.
17.
He was supposed to be involved with Triple H, Undertaker, and I guess he showed up, and that's the alleged time that Triple H kind of ratted him out and Sean flipped out.
Then that was the one I was thinking of.
Okay.
So, no, I don't remember why. Not in this case.
Okay.
Sorry, Sean. Didn't mean to accuse you.
Well, I'm wondering if it just really had to do with him just not being available as much. I don't know, because it seemed like they didn't really use him that much, and then as soon as Foley came on, he was on every show all over the place.
It could have been... Again, this was not like, you know, this wasn't booking the WrestleMania main event. This was just changing one legacy babyface commissioner for another. So I it doesn't ring a bell as to any earth-shattering trouble. But it could have been. It could have just been that he... Now, Russo was gone by this point, right?
Yes.
Okay, it wasn't that he hated Russo because he did. Was he getting married?
No. I don't know if that happened yet.
That's possible.
It could have been around the wedding.
Because he was still all screwed up while he was married, right?
Yeah, they tell the story in the DVD of him eating the cookies and all that kind of jazz. Yeah, no, he definitely was married when he was still a mess.
Right.
So it could have been that.
That's what it could have been.
Mm.
It's so funny how he was able to turn things around. Not to get sidetracked, but...
It's true.
Sean.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He could have been, should have been dead. If you think about the all the other wrestlers that have died.
I mean, his life almost, and I'm not being really obscure, but his life up until that point almost mirrored like Gino Hernandez. You know, a guy who was a good looking guy who had a pretty good career, but I mean, obviously Gino didn't win world titles like Sean did, but then just kind of got caught up in his own paranoia and his own demons and ended up dead. And fortunately for Sean, he kind of turned his life around. But
was Shawn Michaels also the illegitimate son of Paul Bosch?
No, he might have been the illegitimate.
That would be like super eerie.
He might have been the illegitimate son of Joe Blanchard because he was in San Antonio. So Lord, who only knows? Might be one of those Texas promoters.
And I did say eerie on purpose because Paul Bosch had big gigantic ears. Way inside baseball right now. We're really, you know, most of the audience is going, please just get to the recap. I want to find out what D'Lo Brown did.
Well, just to finish this up, Sean was married March 31st, 1999. He had his son was born in January 2000. So maybe it was just a case of him wanting to just be done and take some time with him, I'm guessing.
Could have been it, yep.
Okay. Mm. All right, so around the same time coming out of King of the Ring, Vince McMahon left television. He said he was going to go home to be the genetic jackhammer. Daddy's coming home. And any thought process behind him leaving? Was it just kind of we need to freshen things up? We're done with the whole McMahon-Helmsley thing for a while. Anything more than that?
No. And this was one of those episodes where it was, you know, where I was just like, do we really need to go there? Do we need to hear about this? No, I really didn't need to. Yeah, I think it was it. Just go home, freshen things up, take some time off of TV. And if Jesse Ventura was around, he would probably say he was going to get a new toupee.
Yes.
But now Jesse Ventura says that all of the toupees that Vince McMahon wore were planted by the CIA.
Jesse, I listened to him on Howard Stern. I was driving out to Boston for work, and they were talking about their platform for when they run for president next year. It was it's quite the listen, Kevin Kelly. Quite the listen.
Yeah. I did read one conspiracy theory today that Obama had both Breitbart and who was the author who just died, the famous
Vince
author of Red October.
Oh, Tom Clancy.
Tom Clancy, he had both of them whacked, so.
Oh, makes sense.
Jesus.
Right, exactly.
Scott, did you write that one?
No, I actually put Vince Flynn, because I think he writes better books than Tom Clancy.
Did R.J. Brewer write that?
R.J. Brewer. He definitely wrote it. Actually, Breitbart's not dead. He's in his basement. He's in R.J. Brewer's basement. That's the conspiracy.
L. Dandy.
Yeah. nobody doubts R.J. Brewer, or that other guy. Do you think it was good for the product? Was Vince tiring on TV?
I don't know. Dominating is a big word, but it just could be that he just needed to take time off just to take time off. Go away to come back, you know? And when you have somebody like that, yeah, it's tough. It makes it easier when he's not on TV.
Hmm.
Because he's, again, think about it. He's got 50,000 things going on, right? And Vince, we need you to shoot 5 pre-tapes because you're all over the show. And then now all of a sudden you don't get them done, and great, now we're doing them live. Okay. So it's easier for everybody when Vince is not on the show, trust me. It's also easier when Vince is not around because then everything just magically flows. It's a wonderful day. It only happened a couple of times when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like, teacher's away, let's have fun. It was, man, let's get all this done and make it great.
Right.
So.
In the build of Fully Loaded, our first pay-per-view of the second half of the year, what was the feeling with the focus on the 3 young guys? You had Jericho, you had Benoit, you had Angle. And them trying to break through that, quote-unquote glass ceiling. Did you think any of them should have won? Taker lost, or Taker beat Angle, Triple H beat Jericho, Rock beat Benoit. Should any of them won those matches?
I have written about this particular pay-per-view and those 3 matches probably more than any other singular event other than Mick Foley getting screwed out of his WrestleMania main event. Mm-hmm. I really, truly felt in my heart, in my gut, that at least one of the 3 needed to win, and that it really just sent a bad message. It sent a consistent message. It sent the same message that we had seen, any other time in wrestling when Jim Crockett Promotions bought the UWF. UWF guys get squashed. Anytime WWF brought in anybody new guy gets squashed. We saw it later in the next year in the invasion angle. I don't know. It's the glass ceiling meets what's best for business. And having one of those 3 guys slip over on whomever it might have been. I mean, didn't Rock treat – who did Rock wrestle? Which one? He wrestled Benoit, right?
Benoit,
yep, for the title.
Treated him like a jobber.
I wouldn't go that far. I didn't think so. Angle is the one that looked awful. Taker just beat
Angle
the shit out of him.
Angle was booked to look like an idiot.
Yeah,
and that sucked.
And I hated it.
And to me, he's the one that clearly should have won, because I can get not taking the title off Rock again. And Triple H was red hot at that point, too, and Jericho looked great. I mean, he literally lost by a half a second in that last man standing. So that one didn't even bother me. I think Angle-Taker was the one where there was a clear opening for a win.
Yeah, but how are you going to do it? Right. So it's a but nobody was left laying. Nobody was really, everybody was, and I remember being there in Dallas and just like, I disagree. I couldn't say anything, but I disagree, I disagree, I disagree, I disagree. And still disagree to this day.
The weird thing with Angle, too, is I know you say like a new guy comes in, he gets buried. I mean, Angle was their own homegrown guy. It was just weird that they treated him that way.
I never understood. I understood very little of what they did with Kurt Angle. I really did. And I think part of it was not a disrespect towards Kurt Angle, but Kurt was sort of markish in a way. Kurt would do stupid things and take stupid bumps. Like he took that stupid moonsault bump off the top of the cage on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's just stupid. And I think that when... I don't know what it is. I think Vince sees everything through the prism of television. And if he sees somebody portrayed as a goof on TV, he's going to book them as a goof in matches that are on TV. Does it sound strange to you? I know we've touched on this before. Vince sees everything through the prism of television. If you're booked like King Kong, Vince is going to think you're King Kong, even though he's the one that put the match together. Like recently when Big E Langston did that thing with who was the girl that he catfished?
Caitlin.
Right. As soon as I saw that, I was like, in my mind, I thought, Vince is never going to see this Big E Langston as the indestructible bodyguard again. He's going to think he's like this smooth womanizer type thing. Like, he doesn't understand deep characters. He only sees it for what it is. He's very shallow, and he's very, because his attention span is so slight. Amazing. Amazing that he's gone as far as he has. So, yeah, I was very, very frustrated with that pay-per-view and with the outcome of those three matches. But it wasn't my company. Why'd I get upset about it?
Do you think Angle was kind of punished in a way too? Not punished, but I don't say maybe taken advantage of because he was so good and so adaptable in so many ways that he almost kind of gets, oh yeah, okay, Kurt can do some comedy, let's just have him do this thing. Oh, Kurt can kind of be goofy, let's have him do this, and they kind of shift around because he was so talented in so many areas.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. That could be part of it too. The less negative approach that you take there is a good way to say it.
Okay. Maybe a combination of the two.
Right. You know, like he gets knocked out for real when he's supposed to have a concussion.
Right. Yeah.
In SummerSlam.
He's very dedicated to the... Actually, we're going to talk about that because we'll get to that in a few minutes.
We're getting to it, but you know what I mean?
Right.
So
yeah.
I think, yeah, that there is a part of that. Right. Art imitating life.
All right,
or life imitating art.
And speaking of art imitating life, and this one, the right to censor, Kev, where did this thing come about? Did you like it? Did you like the role for Stevie? Did he seem kind of lost before this? When we had him on the show, he seemed to not mind the gimmick. He just hated his own kind of physical appearance at that time. But he seemed to not mind the actual role. What was your overall thoughts of that?
This was a Vince McMahon brainchild. This was his idea in a response, of course, to the Parents Television Council. When he gets motivated on things like this, Vince fixates and really goes to the nth degree. I thought it was perfect for Stevie. I was really happy for him. I thought the cast that they put around him, as it evolved over time and grew and morphed, I thought it was all, you know, well used and everything. I tease Stevie because he always gives himself such a hard time about his physical appearance. He did say that, though, it was the heaviest he ever was, like, I think, in his life. So, you know, when you have to wear a shirt and tie and, you know, trousers, so that's your wrestling attire, I guess it's a little easier.
Right. Ask IRS.
Exactly right. Master of the abdominal stretch.
And now Stevie is in the complete opposite shape of when he was in the RTC. The guy's a machine now. But
when Stevie and I worked together... First of all, Stevie got really dedicated to fitness, mm-hmm. I don't know, probably 6, 7, 8 years ago, just began at the end of the Right to Censor, went overboard, and is a complete lunatic. Like, when he and I worked together as announcers for Lucha Libre USA, we split a room, and he'd be up at like 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning to go work out when he has a flight, like at 6. He was a crazy person. And he would do, you know, stretchy bands down the hallway or whatever it is. And now he's an instructor with DDP Yoga, and I mean, it's great.
Yeah, he is all in on that.
Right. It's fantastic, and I'm really happy for him. He's, you know, he's one of the nicest guys I've ever met. He's one of my, you know, longest friends in wrestling. So, and we always pick up just like right where we left off.
Yep, very good guy. We had him on. We went, oh, God, Scott, what did we go, over 2 hours? And then he stayed on the line and talked to us for an hour after.
I know, just BSing, yeah.
Really cool guy. We had a good time.
Another match, Kev, that was on that Fully Loaded card was the Intercontinental title cage match between Val Venus and Rikishi. Would you consider that a breakthrough for Rikishi as like a more legit contender rather than just the big pal for Too Cool?
It was, and I remember thinking that this match was going to kind of get lost in the shuffle. You know, it's great to put the Intercontinental title on the line in a cage, but when you got those three big star-powered main events, I think a lot of people forget about that match. But I thought it was good. I looked at it more in terms of both guys proving that they could deliver in a big money spot and that there wasn't hesitant, you know, that either of them could have been main eventers. I always thought both could have been main eventers. Val, of course, was hindered by his name. Jim Ross and I had had the discussion, and Jim said, you're never going to hear new World Wrestling Federation champion Val Venus.
Is that because it rhymes with penis?
What? It does?
He didn't champion want it to at the time. Stop it.
Champion doesn't rhyme with penis.
Oh, Val does.
Val, exactly. So there was always going to be that ceiling that was above him. And with Rikishi, too, how much really could you do, even though the guy could work circles around 90% of the roster? What would you do with a guy that's like that, who's sort of almost in this comedy thing kind of exclusively, and is, you know, the one move thing of the stink face is really over? How do we get beyond that? And can we? So, entertaining match. Don't know if it was a, you know, great takeaway. Both guys stood out for doing their best to carry the ball. But at the end of the day, I don't know if anything really changed for either guy. I think there may have still been the same perception, especially with Val. I don't think Val ever broke. I think Rikishi had that love that they all had for him. So you're going to get more chances when you're Rikishi.
All right, where did the Taz, Jerry Lawler, Jim Ross thing come from? Did you like the idea from Taz, and then eventually they added Raven to the mix? Did you think that was a good fit for him? It seemed like it was at least something for Taz to do after kind of just meandering around. Just tell us a little bit about that angle.
Agree. It was a good thing to do, especially when he would. We were seeing sides of a personality that we had never seen before. So I thought that it was really good. And talk about a guy that made lemonade out of lemons. You know, was booked one way, brought in one way, and within 6 months was completely doing something else.
I don't know if we ever talked about the Raven story on this. Is it true that Vince said, who the fuck hired Raven, when he walked in and saw him backstage?
Ha! That's funny. I don't know. It wouldn't shock me. There was always a story that the McMahons didn't like Raven.
Right.
Because when he was Johnny Polo, he corrupted Shane. So, I don't know.
He
corrupted him for the business, or took him out and did shots?
Yeah.
Yeah, that type of thing.
Probably worse than shots, but... Yeah. That was a good pop he got, too, debuting in Philly, but I think they should have brought it back as Johnny Polo. I thought there was way more to do with that character than Raven.
Okay, so you were the one.
Johnny Polo's awesome, don't you dare.
You're exactly right.
Did you think it was weird, though, they had Taz lose that first match of SummerSlam to Lawler? Like, do you think that hurt his momentum at all, or do you think he's just, the charisma kind of carried him past it?
It didn't bother me if he would have, by having him lose to Lawler. It wasn't at that point. Now we're trying to build an invincible monster.
Right.
At this point, we're trying to slot a mid-card act, you know, so they could, if he loses, it's okay. Because he's going to get his heat back, and he did.
I had a follow-up, and now I blanked on it. Oh, well, had they already started the conversion? Because around this time, he started co-hosting Heat, and he was doing some SmackDown, like, backstage announcing. When did the idea come to start to move him over?
Probably in the wake of the fallout with him and you know, the wrestling side and not really fitting in and not really being, you know, what they had wanted. So there were people in the TV studio that liked Taz a lot. Understandably so. He's a great guy. And I think there were some people that were probably kind of championing that cause because he was talented. And let's see what he can do. And he's got such a great personality. He makes us laugh. And he really does. He makes you laugh with the things that he says and the way he says them. And we saw that on Heat. You know, that was the perfect vehicle for him.
Now, one guy who was kind of lost in the shuffle towards the second half of the year because of some other issues was the Big Show. He was getting pretty portly. Just starting to get out of shape, and talk about his weight issues and when he was, what was the kicker that got him demoted?
Oh, I don't remember the kicker. I'm sure that Taker was part of it. That Taker, whether it was a match with Taker, or whether it was something to do with that. I think it definitely had something to do with that, with Taker really just wanting him to kind of step up. And it was frustrating for everybody, and it was a lot of tough love, because they really, you know, they had made a big investment in him. They saw huge dollar signs, and it was not, you know, he wasn't seeing through on his end of the bargain. Could have been just maturity issues. Could have been any number of things. But at the end of the day, it was his responsibility. And when had they sent him down to OVW? Was it at this point that they had sent him down?
Yeah, it was like in August. He had come back. He did like an injury angle. He was gone for a couple of months, came back, and he was set to fight Undertaker, SummerSlam. And then it was like 2 weeks before, because I remember I was at the show that night in Providence, and the word kind of broke on the internet that he had been demoted. And then they did the, and this is our next question, I'll just ask it now, they ended up hot-shotting Kane heel and a turn in, and they did that awful fight at SummerSlam with him and Taker. But so yeah, it was around August that he got demoted, and I don't think he comes back until the Rumble, I believe.
Right, and so that was the, and that was why Undertaker was so, and they had probably worked each other on some house shows, and Taker finally said, listen, I can't do this. He's going to hurt me or both of us, more than likely me.
Do you think it ruined Kane's momentum to abruptly turn him heel? I felt like he was still pretty hot as a face since he came with Paul Bearer earlier in the year, and then had the feud with X-Pac, and then he was kind of in the mix of the world title. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they turn him heel just to fill this one slot with Taker. And they did that terrible, it's a terrible fight. It's not even a match. And Taker rips his mask off and he's, you know, runs scampering to the back. Do you think they should have maybe booted that whole program and not wasted the time with turning Kane?
Probably in hindsight. I mean, what did they wind up doing with Kane after that? Kane's the guy that's turned 57,000 times in his career.
Yeah, he was heel for a little bit longer, but not really. No one really gave a shit, it didn't seem like, because it just came out of nowhere. It really made no sense.
Right. Yeah, I didn't agree with that. Anytime you do anything for short-term reason, it's like, okay, well, it's a big show, and it's, you know, and it's the, you know, and it's Undertaker. We got to do something important, impressive. No, you don't.
Obviously, Kane and Undertaker were not the big feud at getting into SummerSlam, thank God. But this now burgeoning love triangle between Kurt Angle, Stephanie, and Triple H. What were your thoughts on that whole storyline, the big kiss before SummerSlam, and that main event, Angle's concussion? Talk about it. What did you think of how that played out?
That was one of the most real things that has ever been on television, and got completely squashed because of how real it was. The kiss thing with Kurt and Stephanie, that was going places. It was just going to be the start of something that was really going to have legs. But I think Triple H had that squashed. Which is one of the reasons why I always thought they booked him as a goof.
To make him not look like a threat.
Yeah, right. It's punishment.
Angle's concussion, so that was, you kind of touched it briefly earlier. So that was supposed to be, he was supposed to get a concussion. Basically how that match went down is how it was supposed to go down, right? He was supposed to leave, Stephanie was supposed to talk him into going back, and he's supposed to come back. Was that all the
same?
Exactly. Okay.
Except he got KO'd for real. And it was another opportunity for Vince, like when Lawler had the heart attack.
Right.
Get him back in the match.
Yeah. Listen here, Hermie. So he had Kurt go back out. He goes, does the thing, and Stephanie takes a rock bottom at the end. So the love triangle didn't end there at SummerSlam. It continued on into Unforgiven. And that's where Triple H defeated Angle, and Stephanie turned on Kurt and made out with Triple H and everything else. Did you think right there, A, did you feel like it killed any momentum they had building with any kind of female demographic? B, did they just completely blow it, or did you see any kind of positive in going the way they did?
And, there was nothing positive at all about that whole thing. It was just, to me, it was just short-sighted, bitter, and vindictive.
Hmm. So you agree Triple H had to go face, Angle had to go heel with Stephanie?
They sure had a good chance to do that, didn't they? But that's Triple H's comfort zone, you know? And whatever. I always thought Triple H was extremely overrated. And Scott, I'm sorry. I know it's your man crush, but I just didn't. You know, geez, I just didn't like this whole thing at this time with the way Stephanie was. And I got it. You know, y'all are doing the deed. I completely get it, but
so the behind the scenes thing squelched the storyline?
Oh yeah, exactly. 100%. Ask anybody that was there, they'll tell you.
Do you feel like that was the peak creatively? I know they'd be red hot for a while longer, but do you feel like it was never as good as it was in those weeks in and out of SummerSlam?
Well, when was Chris Kresge there?
Well, that was our next question. He leaves, I believe, at the end of 2000, right towards the tail end. And then Stephanie apparently took over from what we know. Do you know why Chris left and what led to Stephanie taking over? And was that part of this whole thing?
I don't know whether Chris got burned out or what, but I don't think it pointed to one episode or anything like that. He was loved by everybody. Everybody really liked him. So embrace the fact that he was a Hollywood guy, that he was a wrestling fan, that he was there to, you know, bring out the entertaining aspects of whatever and didn't really delve into the wrestling part of it. You know, was just a good dude, really. So I felt like when, and at first I didn't like it because, again, it's a non-wrestling guy. And I despise them, by and large, in any wrestling involvement at all. But he was a good guy that everybody liked. So,
Was his booking as detailed as kind of the legend has it, where he really went deep, far out into the year, storyboarded everything? Was that all true?
Yep, he was, and to me, the best thing that he did was, of course, you give logic and you give reason. He knew how to argue / convince Vince of things, and did it kind of with a smile on his face, and it just had a good way about him, but was very, very smart, and came in with all of his I's dotted and all of his T's crossed.
So I take you back then to that other question. Do you feel like between the love triangle ending and Kresge leaving, that was the peak creatively at the time?
What was the... Okay, so we still... The peak, the absolute peak of everything, was Rock and Austin the following year.
Right. I agree with that.
So working backwards from that, we were getting towards the beginning of the end.
Okay, so that's yeah. All right, so let's call it the beginning. They've hit the top of the mountain, and now we plateau for a bit, and then we start to go down after 17.
Right.
Is that, okay.
Exactly. And then, of course, Scott's world comes to an end when the two-man power trip ends with a blown quad.
Rehabbed with a blown... All right. Go ahead, Scott.
Let's switch gears. Talk about another on-air relationship that was going on, and that was between Eddie Guerrero and China. Was it time for them to split up after being together for a few months, and did you like the angle involving her being in Playboy?
Yeah, I thought that was really well done, and if you're going to bring people together to separate them, she was going to take a lot of time off, I guess, for all the publicity. So it kind of made sense to sort of separate them and give Eddie's character a little more edge, right? Because he was the jealous, jilted guy who didn't want to see Mamacita in the pages.
Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
So, yeah, it gives them a reason to be, a reason to do, a reason to, you know, have a bitch. So that's like, that's how, that's found money when stuff like that happens and you work with somebody. Oh, wait, great. I get to play with that. You know, fantastic.
Did you enjoy when Eddie went to the Playboy Mansion?
One of my most favorite non-wrestling segments ever in history. Just thinking about, you know, the Grotto and Eddie Guerrero. It's classic stuff.
What are your thoughts on Eddie at this point? Did they see the money in him yet? Or is it just kind of like, oh, this guy's entertaining. He'll be a good entertaining mid-card kind of act. Still kind of falling behind in the ranks to Benoit for the Radicals and the WCW guys? Or did they know that someday this guy was going to be the star he became?
I don't think they knew he was going to be the star, but they were like, I think they were so impressed because he had come in that vanilla midget class, as it was termed by Kevin Nash, and that, you know, that they weren't going to be all, there was one at least that had some charisma, unlike the thought was on Benoit, Guerrero, Benoit, Malenko, and Perry Saturn. So I think there was, well, my gosh, well, we know we can wrestle good. That's we don't care about wrestle good. We want entertaining. And, yeah, he can entertain. He can entertain the hell out of things. Oh, my gosh, thank God. Boy, he's so good. And was the biggest thing that everything comes back to is it easy to work with the guy? And that was the deal. Eddie was so easy to work with. Everybody loved him.
Do you feel the sense that Rock's title reign, which he finally had fought so long to have this long title reign, finally gets it, but do you think he was completely overshadowed by the other angles, mainly the love triangle and everything else? It seemed like he never had a heated feud. He just kind of bounced from contender to contender. Even at SummerSlam, he's just kind of inserted into the Triple H angle stuff. Do you feel like after all the build and all the hype, he kind of got kind of a fart in church with this title reign?
Yeah, and again, he didn't have a lot to play with, because I think there was, you know, a lot of belief, oh, we've seen him in Triple H. I don't think either guy really cared for each other, so it was kind of easy for them to not play together. And certainly if Chris Kresge is your lead writer, and he said your lead writer is a non-wrestling guy, and you know that, you know where the bread is buttered, and that's with Triple H. I'm going to come up with, and Kurt being, you know, so multifaceted, multi-talented, and such a good foil for anything that anybody wanted to do, whether he was a heel or a babyface, isn't it easy for Kresge to write stuff like that? You know?
Indeed. Do you think that's why they got Benoit in there and
what do they do? And then they get Benoit in there, and what happens?
Rock beats him. Yep.
He drops out.
Right.
But do you really think they should have taken the title off Rock already? And that was a month after he won it.
What are you going to do? So now you beat Benoit, right? You beat Benoit. And what? Now he's the guy who can't win.
You think one match put that stigma on him?
Yes. Because it wasn't one match. It was three matches and a card. I looked at the whole event in its totality. It annoyed the hell out of me.
So let me ask you this. If Kurt had won and then Benoit lost the same, it wouldn't have bothered you as much?
Not as much, no.
What did you think of all the, getting back to Benoit real quick, what did you think of all the false finishes? Like the false finish at Summer at Fully Loaded.
Unforgiven, they did one too.
And in Unforgiven, they did it again. Did that annoy you just as even more than if he just flat out lost?
Yeah.
Like almost like dangling a carrot in front of the diehards and then, you know.
Exactly.
Pulling it away.
Exactly.
All right, as we get out of SummerSlam, we finally get into the storyline that everybody wants to see end, as it's been dangling for quite a few months. Steve Austin comes back from his rehab from the neck surgery, But of course, kayfabe it is to find out who ran him over that previous November in Detroit. Turns out that it was the aforementioned Rikishi.
Mm-hmm.
Was he always intended?
Yeah, did it for the Samoans.
Was he always intended to be the driver? Did you like that decision and how it ended up playing out? And did you think Rikishi needed to, because this is a bone of contention with my PIC, now that he was a heel, should he have lost the diaper and all that other jazz and looked a little more evil?
Had no problem with it because I don't think they knew who it was. I think Steve was the one who chose it to be Rikishi. And if he didn't make the choice, he signed off on it. It wasn't done against his wishes.
Okay.
I seem to remember there being some sort of tie-in, which I don't think they ever went to, with it being, or did they, with The Rock, him being Samoan and Rikishi being Samoan? Did we go down that route?
Yeah, that was the reason Rikishi gave when he first made the announcement. He said he did it for The Rock because they're family and because Rock never got a fair chance. Samoans were always held down. There's never been a Samoan champion. Yeah, that was definitely all in there.
Right, okay. I think that would sort of delay the groundwork for the whole WrestleMania match.
Okay.
To get them back in the conversation with each other.
Makes sense, yeah.
Do you think he was a good choice? I mean, beyond the fact that Austin signed off, do you think of all the guys on the roster, you were cool with him being the one?
Yeah. I again, because what wound up happening, he got, what, one, two matches out of it?
Yeah.
So, good. You know, it was somebody that was safe for Steve to work with, which was important. And because he was on borrowed time, at least that was the thought, that was the belief internally, and it was a chance for him to step up.
How about the look? Do you think they should have changed? I found it hard to take him serious as this murderer, attempted murderer, this badass, and he's still out there in the same look that he had when he was dancing with Too Cool, the same diaper, the same dong, everything else. I just felt like they should have changed that look, to even to give him some kind of like boxing shorts or tie, anything I thought would have looked better than him still out there in the same kind of goofy attire.
To be honest, it's not something I had ever thought of, had ever contemplated, or had ever talked to anybody about. But you might be right. I would agree that if they would have done something different costuming-wise, you know, I think it would have been perhaps a little different.
Was Austin ready to come back when he came back? Because he was definitely looked a little bit like they were protecting him. He only had a couple of brawls on pay-per-view the first couple months and no TV matches or anything. Do you think he was a little ahead of schedule?
Think about this. He should never have wrestled again. So, yeah. It depends on the medical point of view that you want to go with. Is he ahead of schedule? Well, considering that the number of matches he should have left in his life are zero, then yes, he's way far ahead of schedule.
So he was really told never to wrestle again?
Well, yeah. Most wrestlers are when they have fusion surgery and broken necks. So, and that's not being smart-ass. That's just because that's what doctors do. They look at an X-ray of an MRI of a neck of a wrestler, and it's like, oh, my God, what are you doing? You should quit. But, yeah, that fusion surgery that he had was nasty. In many ways, it was ahead of its time.
Right.
Yeah, because it went through the front. They went through his neck, the front of his neck.
Right.
Do you feel he should have hung it up? Did you feel he had nothing left to prove, or did you feel like they needed him back?
I never look at something like that as a company needs anybody from anything. I think it's up to the decision making of the individual. If you want to come back and you want to try it, okay, great.
We're going to do everything that we can to protect you. And I think that that was, I think Vince and everybody in charge said the same thing to Steve. If you never want to wrestle again, that's fine. But if you do, we'll make sure everything's cool and we'll protect you.
Now, we talked earlier about the awesome right to censor and our boy Stevie Richards. We talked about Val being added to the mix. He would eventually join, complete with Ice Cream Man pants. And then they added that they needed to probably add a woman to the mix to kind of counter the women's division, so they brought in Ivory. What'd you think of those additions?
I loved it. I thought everything that they did was perfect and right on. And, you know, I think Val had reached his peak where he had gone as far as he could go. Time for a new, fresh outlook on things. And no better way to present Ivory, who is one of the sweetest women I've ever worked with. Just when she had that dress on, right? And she would just kind of look and kind of sneer her face towards the crowd when they would say, it was hysterical. It was like school mom, you know. I thought it was perfect casting, absolutely perfect.
She was definitely the best one to put in that role of the women.
Well, just think about, too, you got the gravelly voice Stevie Richards, the gravelly voice Val Venus. You got the high-pitched, squeaky, you know, of Ivory. It was great. You know, size differences, look differences, everybody was different.
And she was probably the best in-ring at this time. I mean, Molly had just come in, and she was solid. But I think it was kind of a good... They picked the right woman, not only just character-wise, fit-wise, but also in-ring-wise, to kind of be the main female in this group.
Right, I couldn't... Trish had just... hadn't been there that long. She wasn't right.
Yeah, Lita was kind of a good spot person, but not really. I wouldn't have classified her at the time as a great, like, working a great match or anything.
And could have never done the promos.
Right.
Not at that point.
Yeah, no, Ivory was perfect. Do you feel that Good Father coming from Godfather is one of the best name switches of all time?
One of the absolute best.
And just brilliant, right?
Yeah, but he would so never, good. Gosh, I mean, as great as he was, he would never be anything but Godfather to me.
Yes. It was a little weird to see for a while there, but I thought it was good. I thought he needed a break from the Godfather stuff. I thought it had kind of reached its end for a while there. I thought it was a good switch for him.
Yeah, the Good Father is one of those stoner moments that you come up with, you say, and then you laugh.
Yes.
Not
yes.
That anybody's ever booked WWF TV stoned.
No, I can't imagine.
Oh, no, no way.
All right, thoughts on the Conquistadors angle? Edge and Christian's continued chemistry, the humor. Remember, they were playing the kazoos. They were still hanging around Kurt Angle. Were they quickly becoming two of the best on TV in this kind of style in 2000? And also, where did the whole Conquistadors thing come from?
I'm trying to remember if we did something in the WWF magazine or if we did something somewhere that piqued the eyes of somebody on the creative team. I don't know. Or it just could have been one of their many childhood memories that they brought forward. But just an opportunity to do something silly, to have them play dress up and be in a different role. I think that was pretty much what they were going for.
What was your thoughts on Edge and Christian as a whole? Did you think they had potential to become stars as singles guys? Did you think their peak was kind of as the entertaining tag team? Did you see one more than the other?
I thought I thought the peak had come and that they were kind of settling into their eventual inevitability. I was proven wrong, and I thought, I always thought that Christian was better in the ring than Edge, but Edge wound up having a much bigger upside than Christian, obviously. So it did surprise me. But I thought what they were doing at this particular time was the natural extension of what they needed to do, what they were going to do, and what they were good at. They were very good at the comedy thing.
Which of the kazoo themes was your favorite? You got Chris Benoit's here and he's really mad. You've got
Chris Benoit's here and he's really mad. Chris Benoit is here and he's really angry. Yeah, that was my favorite.
You had My Time. You had, I think they did their own theme, and you had the Hardcore Holly one, which was good as, or Crash Holly. I'm sorry, they did. But.
Right. No. This is Chris Benoit and he's really mad.
They were great.
The best was when Kai and Tai would do that. You never got to hear that on TV, though, right?
No, I don't think so. They did kazoo music? Mm.
They would sing it.
Oh, geez.
It was a
that would have been tremendous.
Should have been recording this stuff at the time, Kevin.
Maybe he would just do the... Bah, 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 bah. I think Taka would just do that part.
The short-lived group, we kind of didn't touch on it because it was earlier in the year, but with Shane as the manager, and it was like Kurt, Benoit, Edge, and Christian, they're all kind of under him. Like, he wasn't their full-time manager. They're all kind of associated. I thought they had a lot of potential. That was like a killer stable led by Shane, who I thought was an under... As crazy as it may seem, I thought Shane was very underused in 99-2000. Did you think that thing could have went somewhere? I feel like they killed it quickly.
I don't even remember it.
Yeah, it was so brief. It was around Fully Loaded. They were all working together, and Shane was... Because Shane's with Benoit in that match, but he was also kind of with Kurt and definitely with Edge and Christian. They were all helping each other out. Do you agree that Shane was kind of underused during this time?
I think they were trying to figure out what to do with Shane. He had wrestled. I don't think they wanted him wrestling anymore because he had gotten hurt.
Well, around this time he did the SummerSlam match with Blackman where he took that crazy fall off the thing and Blackman jumped on top of him.
Mm-hmm. Was that before or after? It was after.
It was right after the stable with Benoit and all that. That was like in July, and this was August when he took the bump from Blackman.
Right. I think it was the idea of, we don't want to see him wrestle because he's the big, he does the crazy big spots. He had done the commentary thing, but they didn't want to go back and have him do that. Let's just try to find ways to plug him in, I think was the thought.
Well, it was him and the story there is kind of gone that he was tight with Blackman. Is that why he worked to get him over in that feud? They boys?
No, not particularly.
Oh, that was always kind of the story out there. So was there any reason they had him die for Steve Blackman?
Just to get Blackman over.
Okay.
That was the type of guy Shane was. You know? He might have marked for Blackman a little bit. He fashioned himself as a practitioner of pugilistic prowess. Shane McMahon.
Did you like Blackman at the hardcore stuff still? I thought he was the best hardcore champion they've had.
Yeah.
Oh, the most legit by far, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt. Don't get me started on head cheese. That turned my stomach.
You weren't a big Chester McCheeserton fan?
Oh. That Brian Gewurz.
Ugh. One guy that was added to the roster 2 years, almost 2 years to the month when he first joined under a worse gimmick, and that was Steven, now William Regal. What were your thoughts on him coming back, and did they see him as a potential like guy that could be pumped up to the main events and maybe be a big time champion in the future? What were your thoughts on that, on him?
It was one of the great reclamation stories that I was kind of on the front lines for. He had, sunk to the deepest depths and got himself cleaned up, began to rebuild his life and his career, humbled himself, and volunteered basically to wrestle on the Brian Pillman tribute show. He, early in 2000... he and Benoit have a 20-minute main event at the end of a 4-hour show in a 90-some-odd degree building where they had seen every star under the sun, including WCW guys, WWF guys, everything. Crowd started chanting boring because it was wrestling. They wrestled over 20 minutes. They never hit the ropes once, and at the end got a standing ovation. So to see Regal come back, I didn't care what they called him. As long as he got to be a wrestler, he got to wrestle. He was good. Did they know? Did they think he could be a main eventer? I don't think they could ever say this is a future world champion, because I think there was always it's too much wrestling, it's not enough entertainment. It was never like a slam dunk yes. Like Eddie Guerrero was not a slam dunk yes because of his size, but with his heart and his tenacity and the entertainment, it overcame all that. Austin was a yes, of course. Rock, Triple H, the no-brainers, right? Big Show, who we talked about earlier, should have been a no-brainer, but became his own adversary to the inevitability. With Regal, I was so happy to see him. Then after that, then to finish the story, before he got called up to the main roster again, he was put in charge of training guys in Memphis and was basically driving back and forth between Memphis and Atlanta. He would be in Memphis for 12 days and then go home for two and then come back, and was training the guys. And when it first started, they didn't even have an indoor training facility. They were training literally in a backyard, and eventually got a building and ran a bunch of live events, and Regal was on all the shows and trained a lot of guys and worked hard and did everything that was asked for him and then some. And what a pro's pro, one of my all-time favorite guys.
And if you guys haven't seen that match, I have references. It's actually on, I think it's on Benoit's DVD.
Yes.
It's out of print now, but it definitely lives up to the hype Kevin just laid on it. It's very, very
good. Yeah, it is.
Recalled by Michael Cole and Tom Pritchard.
Mm-hmm.
And they did an outstanding job. But, yeah, it's one of the best matches you'll ever see.
Were there any other good matches on that show? I know there's a lot of names. Anything else you remember from that?
Nope. Just a lot of stars.
Mm-hmm.
And a long show. And a hot show. Yeah, in fact, they went out there in the main event spot and did the match that they did, took balls.
Speaking of balls, where the hell did Naked Midian come from? Where did that thing generate?
It was the rib.
Well, it was. I'm sure it was a rib on him at some point. Did he get naked at some point and run around with just his fanny pack on? Yeah, probably. Anything to get a laugh from that guy. He was awesome.
What did he have under the fanny pack? Was it like a thong or something?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think at first he didn't have anything. And then they were like, oh, boy, this could be a problem.
Once he started taking bumps, yes.
Yeah, let's cover up the ball back.
I love that his match with Regal. I think it's at No Mercy. And Regal's going for the Regal stretch, and he realizes what he's about to do with just Naked Midian, and he stops and then just pins him with another move.
Yeah. That was where you got the Regal face, like, turned up in a sneer the whole time.
Huh.
I loved it. Remember China was doing an interview in the ring, and Naked Midian did, like, a run-through? And she, like, lost it. And she's like, there's Naked Midian, laugh.
Yeah, find that.
An odd gimmick. I love that they actually called him Naked Midian, too. Not just...
Mm-hmm. Like, we couldn't just call him Midian.
That's funny. Back to more serious things, though. Well, he wasn't serious all the time, this guy, but... All right, No Mercy in Albany, I think. Yeah, Albany. Kurt Angle completes the unbelievable rookie year and becomes the world heavyweight, the world champion. Was he ready? Did you think he would actually be booked legit, or do you think this was a chump brain?
I always use the term, is he transformational or transitional? I would have bet the house on transitional.
Mm-hmm. I think most people
just probably. Just because of the where we needed to get to for WrestleMania. I didn't know how they were going to get there at this point. But was this a make-good for how they had booked him against The Undertaker, how they had booked him. That's why I never understood the loss to The Undertaker. I didn't understand it. And if you're going to hotshot the belt and take it off Rock, what's the difference if it's 1 month or two?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So anyway.
Yeah, and he not only dropped a taker, and then he lost in the three-way. I mean, he didn't get pinned, but he lost the concussion. Then he lost at Unforgiven to Triple H clean, and then he won the title. So it was a weird right. stretch.
And when you book, now think about this. I'm not a practitioner of the dark arts, but I do understand how to book guys in such a way that they either look strong or the guys they beat, you know, look weak. And if you do all that to Kurt Angle and then you haven't beat The Rock, I'm not saying there were dark forces working against The Rock. I'm just saying that's not the way you book the guy to beat the guy. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And not only that, I mean, I think all of that was a little screwy. It's not even, Kurt didn't even really beat him. And I'm okay with a little bit of interference, but that whole thing, like Rikishi was in the ring for like the last 3 minutes beating up The Rock, basically, and then Kurt just pinned him. So it wasn't even a convincing win for Kurt at all.
Lots of Zabada, as they say.
Mm.
I just had an ice cream sandwich.
I know, we heard you.
Man, an ice cream sandwich is good.
Yeah, they are good.
I thought maybe it was a Hulk Hogan ice cream bar.
No.
Or a Kevin Kelly ice cream bar.
Oh, imagine.
You know what, though?
It'd be a really big, it would be an nice, big ice cream bar.
You know what we're...
Right? Cause I'm a nice guy, and I'm a big guy, and it would be like, you know...
It'd be a very friendly ice cream bar.
Friendly, exactly.
We're quickly approaching the holidays, though, Kevin. That means the next time you're on, you may be chowing down some Christmas cookies again while you talk to us.
Damn right. I can't wait.
And we can have RJ Brewer come shoot on you for eating on air.
My wife has been canning things all summer because we have this huge garden. So we have just like jars of pickles and tomato sauce filling up this entire room in their house. If the apocalypse happens, we're going to be okay. So I've been taking all my advice from RJ Brewer. I'm armed to the teeth, and I've got provisions.
You should start pimping these provisions on during matches. Be like, who needs a can of pickled peppers? Kevin Kelly's your man.
I can't give them away. If I give them away, I'm not going to have any provisions when the apocalypse comes.
You can sell a few. I'm sure you have enough.
See, and that's what happens. See, the squirrel gathers all the nuts, right? But then there's the one lazy squirrel who thinks, I'll get a few later. And then all of a sudden he doesn't have any, and it's wintertime.
Kevin Kelly, hibernating and eating preserves. One more day away from becoming a bear,
right?
Officially.
Was that a Chris Kresge storyline right there?
Probably.
the squirrel in the pickle jar.
I just got like this beard now, and I'm just like looking out my window.
Like Dirty Dutch?
Yeah. Kevin, are you coming to work? No.
He's the voice of Ring of Honor and the king of the preserves, Kevin Kelly.
Yes. Mr. Marmalade.
Yes.
Naked Marmalade.
Yes.
Naked Marmalade.
Oh, this has got really disturbing.
Oh, God. Let's move on to the next one. Go ahead, JR.
Hardcore Holly returned in November. If you remember, he was pretty hot in 2000. He had a great match with Triple H on Sunday Night Heat for the world title. And then Kurt Angle busted his forearm with a moonsault. Do you think that really just completely wrecked his momentum? Do you think he maybe could have climbed the card anymore? Because he was actually one of those guys, you know, being on the internet at the time, there was, of course, the Radicals were hot with the internet crowd. Kurt Angle was gaining a lot of momentum. Taz. And Hardcore Holly got lumped in that group. And I remember that very vividly, that he was a guy a lot of kind of the internet people liked and thought he was a little underutilized. Did you feel that when he came back that was gone? And did you like the addition of Molly to the group?
It was gone when he got his arm broken. Because it wasn't just a regular old break.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bad one. You know, surgery, a lot of time away, and you got to start from scratch. And when you put a girl in the act, nope. Especially with him. Are you kidding me? He would have been a huge overstar if they would have said, hey, Hardcore Holly, we want to put this girl with you. And he would have given you his real thoughts. Has he ever said really what was on his mind? Which he did, I guess, like he did a shoot interview or wrote a book.
Yeah, I heard his book was really good, like one of the best ones.
Because that's when he talks, you listen. My weight has gone up and down my whole life, like crazy, right? And I had lost a bunch of weight, then I gained it all back. And he looked at me and he said, "Kevin, wow, you are fatter than a hog," or something like that. Like he said it right
that's
to
nice.
My face. And I was like, "Yeah, you're right, I am." He was like, "Damn." And it was said out of love. It wasn't like being mean or disrespectful or something like that. It was just brutally honest. And he was right. And that was the thing. He was brutally honest about everything, which is good and bad. I had tremendous respect for him. I really did.
Do you think it's surprising he lasted as long as he did, being that kind of an honest guy?
In the WWF, no. I'm not surprised, because that... he came in sort of with that rap and you know, I think had recommended him. So he just always had that reputation of being a little bit ornery and a little feisty and a fighter. And he stood up for himself. But again, there were a lot of ups and downs. See the new Midnight Express. But then, of course, you know, there was a no-brainer about putting him in the Brawl for All. So I was like, no, he's legit tough. And if you're a legit tough guy, you can always find your way back in with Vince.
You broke up there for 1 second. Who did you say recommended Holly?
Paul Bearer.
Oh, okay.
I believe he did. I'm 95% sure he did.
Well, it makes sense. I think they're both from Alabama, right?
Yep. And both legit tough guys. Okay, not really.
Well, I wasn't going to doubt you.
I made that last part up. The rest of it was true.
It's too bad. I mean, I really thought he was ready to break out that summer. That match with Triple H was really good on Heat. At least in my memory it was. I really do stand by that fact that I thought he was gaining a lot of underground momentum.
But he was somebody that the internet would grow to hate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was a short-lived frame of, like, early 2000 where they were behind him. And they really started hating him later on. But at that time, it was weird that he got lumped in with that group. But I think he was a hard worker at the time and was putting on some good matches, so.
Billy Gunn comes back. He had been out for... That's right. The one. Mr. Marmalade. Billy Gunn comes back. He had a couple injuries this year, but he had come back, and obviously DX was done. The Outlaws were done. What were your thoughts on switching from the ass to the one? And speaking of the New Age Outlaws, Road Dogg needed somebody, so they bring in this Ron Killings, a.k.a. K-Quick. First off, your thoughts on Billy Gunn's switch of character, of gimmick, and then your thoughts on K-Quick and Road Dogg as a team.
Because I think the use of, even though we were moving inevitably and eventually to a very vulgar period of shows over the next few years, where I think Ultimate Warrior had said, the shows are so bad now in like 2003, 2004, you have to watch them through, you know, a peephole. Just with all the salaciousness and everybody had like a fetish and was a weirdo. I still think that the, you know, ass had run its course as far as Billy Gunn's name. Internationally, it didn't work. It was problematic in a lot of reasons, and let's just go with something cleaner that is, you know, that it's a little bit, unfortunately, a little bit more generic and sterile, but that was what they decided to do. I was happy to see him back because I always liked him. He helped me get my start and was one of the best wrestlers, you know, in my era, in the whole of the company. I'd put him almost at the top of the stack. And, of course, Ron Killings came from Memphis. He was, Terry Taylor and I found him on a tape, watching tape in the office, and it was a tag team that he was in with somebody else. And Terry was like, what do you think about this guy? And I was like, well, I don't see anything as partner, but the guy with the dreads and the dancing is pretty cool. And he goes, I agree. We're going to give him a call. And he called him right then and there and said, hey, we want to talk to you, and we want to see you and meet you, and we want to do something with you. So what they did was they wound up hiring him, and they put him in developmental in Memphis, and he was K-Crush. That was his indie name, so we just kept that, and they changed it to K-Quick for whatever reason, because they like to change things. But he was a top guy in Memphis. We booked him as a top guy. So it was he, and what a great guy. Real, you know, good team player, awesome dude, and... and you know that, so yeah, that was great. And putting him with Road Dogg was perfect because they both smoke a lot of weed.
You think Road Dogg looked like he was like someone's dad going through a really bad midlife crisis? He like broke out those overalls and was rapping with this kid. Kind of odd.
Yeah, and a chance to be entertaining and be different and let the kid take a lot of the bumps and the beating. So that was good. Even though Road Dogg is like, I don't know how old Ron is. I can't remember. But I don't know if he was in his 20s when we hired him. Put it that way.
You mean
he
on the...
40, he, Ron Killings could be 45 years old.
Okay, so you're saying he was out of his 20s. I didn't know if you meant he was out or hadn't reached his 20s yet when they hired him.
No. Meaning he was like maybe 30 when we hired him.
Okay.
I could be wrong.
I can tell you right now. He is 41 right now.
Okay, so I was a little bit wrong. So he was in his... you know,
early
late
20s. Yeah.
And Road Dogg was probably 36, 35, maybe at this point. But, yeah, it did look like Father Sunday at the picnic.
I think it was the overalls mainly. It's good to know you were scouting on wrestling tapes, a little bit different than the scout tapes Johnny Ace would start watching, right? A little bit different.
There's a one-legged guy. We need to hire him. No, idiot, you've hired the wrong one-legged guy. Damn, I'm sorry.
Did you like? I like your Russo better. Can you give us a little Russo?
I got to be in the moment.
Okay, sorry. What did you think of Vince Russo's thoughts on? No. What did you think of the reuniting of the Radicals? Did you feel like it was a step back for Benoit?
You put the Radicals together. You give the Radicals to me in WCW. What was I supposed to do? What was I supposed to do with them? Every week I look at the ratings, minute by minute. These people think wrestling is what sells. Thank you.
What did you think of the reuniting of the Radicals? Did you feel like it was a step backwards for Benoit and Eddie? Or did you like that they kind of brought them back together at the end of the year? Kind of as, well, they ended up being Triple H's backup, but...
Yeah, I liked it. Because I don't think we had gotten enough mileage out of it the first time.
Yeah.
It felt fresh because it was like, yeah, this is what we want to see.
So you don't feel like it was a step back for a guy like Benoit who had been kind of...
No. I didn't think that at all. I thought it was a chance to, you know, take care of some unfinished business as a unit.
One of the most unusual feuds that started towards the end of 2000 was between two guys we've already discussed a couple times tonight, and that is Kane and Chris Jericho, all beginning with some spilled coffee.
Coffee, right? Yeah.
Was the build as bad as, you know, history leads us to think that it was bad, or do you think there was supposed to be more to it than it was?
No, I seem to remember it being just because of that.
So I think there was a little bit to it, though.
There seems to be, again, at the, you know, kind of at every television, there would always be a table with coffee out there, right? And I think that was probably one of the rationales given by one of the writers about a way that a feud could start. Just two guys over coffee and bump into each other and they could have a match. So could there have been more than that? Maybe. But I don't think so. I think that was it.
Well, the way they ended up taking it was that Kane said he got mad that, you know, monsters and disfigured people like him weren't loved by the fans, basically, and pretty boys like Jericho were. They kind of went that direction like a week later. I think everyone, the coffee thing sticks out because it's so ludicrous, but I feel like that's kind of become one of those legend stories where, oh, they spilled a cup of coffee and then they hated each other. I think there was, they did build a little bit more than that.
Yeah, you give more to it because, again, are you really mad because you spilled coffee? No, I'm really mad because I'm a disfigured freak and Jericho's a pretty boy.
Right.
He just happened to throw coffee on me and I was in a bad mood.
Yeah.
Getting back to Angle, who was your champion, he fought The Undertaker at the Survivor Series. Obviously, they did the whole switcheroo with his brother, and Angle got the cheap win. Do you mind him having to cheat to win that match, or did he need to win clean for legitimacy?
It was so creative how they did it. No, it doesn't bother me. And when you're a transitional champion anyway, I don't think it matters what you do. As long as you're, I mean, it's not completely cheapening the legacy of the belt. And that was a cool creative finish. So you got to give props for that.
All right. Around this time, Triple H is outed as the mastermind behind Rikishi.
He had cut.
Right. Even after the Kurt stuff, he still kind of was staying face a little bit. And then he kind of finally goes full on heel here. He says, Rikishi wasn't acting alone. So I kind of, when Scott and I were reviewing the show, kind of had this idea, I don't call fantasy booking, but I think maybe better booking, something that they could have done to make it a little bit different. What if they had, you know, Triple H was the mastermind that had done it before, but over the past year leading up to this point, the fans started liking him. He kind of looked at things in a different light. He kind of had more respect for his fellow wrestlers now. And he feels really bad for what he did. He doesn't want anyone to know what he did. So Rikishi starts blackmailing him. And is like, we don't know who it is. We just know Rikishi has someone working with him and he's going to out him. And Triple H is hoping he's not outed. And Rikishi finally outs him. And now all that trust that Triple H had built up was gone. You know, Austin Rock, all these guys hate him. And he's pissed that he's hated because he worked hard to be liked. Almost like a teen coming-of-age movie, you know? Do you think that could have been made everyone look stronger? Like, I think it would have made Rikishi look like even more of an asshole if he outed Triple H. I thought it would have added some depth to Triple H instead of just, I'm the guy behind you, I hate you, Austin. Do you see any kind of merit to that kind of story?
Well, I do, because I see the depth and dimension. I see that component of it. But I also see Triple H's side of it, too. Like, I don't want to be vulnerable and a pussy. That kind of makes me look like a pussy. So
I thought, a little bit, but I also think it makes
unless
him
he's going to kill Rikishi,
right? Oh yeah, that then you turn it to that. You know, maybe that may save Austin eventually, and then he wins the fans back over, and he can still look tough. I mean, he doesn't have to be crying about it, but I feel like it was almost like he earned the fans' respect finally, and then he, you know, this came back to haunt him, something he did a while ago when he was a dick. I don't know, just some wild idea I had one day when I was sitting there listening to the pay-per-view. Look, I got plenty of Warlord fan fiction.
Listen, I always am a fan of that type of stuff.
Well, you should get in to Ring of Honor there, the booking committee, and let them know this idea.
Exactly. We need to book Triple H.
Get him in. Have Rikishi come in too. Run down Michael Elgin, and then next year you can enact this whole pathos play.
Exactly. Rikishi will run down Michael Elgin. That's step one.
But then in the end, Triple H becomes Ring of Honor World Champion for 4.5 years.
Yes.
Love that. Good call, Kev.
Until John Cena comes in and beats him.
Until John Cena comes in and beats him and holds it for 5 years.
What led to the terrible pay-per-view finish with the car, Kevin? Please, this thing was awful, where Austin drops Triple H in the car from 100 feet in the air, and then he's back 2 weeks later after the car was smashed to pieces.
With one Band-Aid.
I don't know. We all agree. this is the Hokies piece of crap ever. But I was in Tampa, so I didn't care. And I was sick. Oh, I was so sick. I had gotten, like, the flu or something. It was horrible.
Hmm.
I think you made that up just to be away from the show when this happened.
No. It's putrid.
Now that I think, you weren't backstage that night, huh? I don't remember you doing any backstage interviews.
No, I was there. I got a bunch of eyewitnesses. Everybody can attest to what I was doing.
Hmm.
You were in the car with Triple H when it smashed?
Yes. Cleaned out your sinuses.
Now, was he really in the car when it fell? No. He, but that was just, I don't know what was running through their mind when they had built the story up to this point. You do this big twist, and then you have Austin basically just, I mean, there's no way he should have lived. There's no way. And then to be back 2 weeks later, it was so absurd. It was one of the most absurd things I had done in a long time.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Do you think Rikishi
completely.
Was...
Completely.
Yeah. Do you think Rikishi was neutered by this whole thing once he was associated with Triple H instead of just being the guy?
Why do you think it was done? As soon as I said, oh, you know, Triple H outs himself as, you know, and of course he was the one that was pulling Rikishi strings. Of course. That's the MO. Glom all of Rikishi's heat. Take it for himself. this makes Scott so upset.
This is killing him. He's going to be binge eating later tonight. I thought
I'm not going to eat his fucking ice cream bars. That's what I'm not going to eat.
Yeah, Christmas cookies for everyone.
Your pickled carrots.
Dan Severn's bringing the Christmas cookies. I thought
Oreos are more addictive than crack. I saw that they are more addictive than cocaine. I read that story today.
I believe it. My wife made, my sister-in-law's baby shower, and she made these awesome chocolate-covered Oreo cookies, and I quickly volunteered to help package them because I did the one for me, one for them routine.
Attaboy.
I thought the explanation they gave for Triple H made sense, though, because he was like, who had the most to gain by Austin being out and all that, and it all kind of tied together with him having risen to prominence during that year. It's just, you know, it's just Triple H, but. I thought the story was okay if it was anyone else.
Wait a minute. All right, I got to ask this now. He wasn't even like... There was a stretch in 2000 where Vince didn't even want him going out with Stephanie anymore behind the scenes. So I don't get how he had like so
Triple
much...
Triple H lied to Scott. That's what we're finding out right now.
Says who?
Huh?
Who told you this, Scott, that he didn't want them going out?
It's on the DVD. He said it, Vince, on the Triple H DVD. Vince said it. Linda confirmed it. That he didn't mind them dating, and then after a few months later and he heard some shit from wrestlers, he kind of changed his mind and he didn't want them dating. But then they just kind of found each other again. It's on the Triple H DVD. My camera phone of him on the couch. I don't think he had that much clout yet, I feel like. Did he really have that much clout?
Yes, he did.
At that point, really?
Oh, yeah.
I don't feel like he was that deep in the...
He and Vince were, like, finishing each other's sentences in production meetings. It was creepy.
It's better than what him and Scott were finishing. Now I'm just picturing Scott as, like, Rob Feinstein in this fucking seedy motel with Triple H interviewing with his camera phone.
Recreating God. That infamous scene from Lady and the Tramp with the,
the piece of spaghetti.
Now tell me about your match with...
It was his penis.
Oh, God.
Hey, it rhymes with Val Venus. Tell me about that match you had with Raymond Roy in the 1994 July 3rd episode of Superstars.
Can I wear your Terror Rising robe?
Yes.
She's in the closet right now anyway.
To catch a predator guy comes in.
Yes, the catcher.
Have a seat right here.
Scott is friggin' jorts.
I got a question.
Jorts!
It's jorts.
And a fanny pack.
Eat an ice cream sandwich.
Anyway. All right,
yeah,
so...
So here's what was going on kind of at that time. Mm-hmm. Triple H was really starting to assert himself. And... Vince was a willing ear, and there was more than one occasion where Hunter would bring up something in a production meeting, and Vince would agree to it, but it would be like the first time he'd heard it, you know? Vince, what if we did this instead of this? I like that idea a lot. But it was so fake. It was like it was a spot they had worked out in the hallway. Hey, when we get down here, pal, on this, you know. Okay, Vince. You know what I mean? It happened more than once, and a couple of us are looking at each other like, what kind of crap is this? Not that we care, but it's just so weird. You know? We get it, Hunter. You're a big suck-up. Go for it. Vince, what if we... oh, that's a good idea. We should do that. So, listen, they can say anything they want on DVDs or whatever. There's no hand on a Bible. There's no lie detector test being hooked up. I call shenanigans on that whole deal. I think Vince wanted the two of them together and wanted to be the third one in the sandwich.
Ew.
The ice Scott, cream Scott will provide the mayonnaise.
The ice cream sandwich?
Yeah, baby.
Vince is passing out Oreos backstage. I know what's going on here. All right. Speaking of Vince, because this is... if any are more food analogies, we might be in trouble. All right. Vince would come back right after Survivor Series, heading towards Armageddon. Why did he come back? The usual, hey, I've been off for a while, the camera needs me. What were some of the reasons he came back?
I don't remember in this particular instance. Where was he inserted? How did he come back?
He came back like a week before the Hell in a Cell at Armageddon. And he was all pissed off that Foley was putting all these great guys inside the cell because it was too violent.
That was where we were leading to the six-way, right?
Yeah, it was the week before that.
When Rikishi took the big bump off the cell into the truck of hay.
Yep.
Okay. God, that was a good match.
Very good match.
Yes.
What was the reason? What was the reason?
He also had a cane. Do you remember why that was there?
No.
Yeah, he did have a cane.
Don't remember that. Jerry Briscoe shot on him.
Oh, jeez.
Did you like the Rikishi bump, or did you think it was unnecessary?
Loved it. I loved that whole match.
Yes, it's a tremendous match.
Yeah, we just talked
multi-man, Hell in a Cell. That's what that's for. You know what I mean? You got
all the
that
top guys.
Footage. Yeah, you got all that square footage to play with. And wasn't that where Rock blacked out my tooth? Maybe Chris Benoit.
No, I don't think so. Because Benoit wasn't involved. That might have been Unforgiven, I think.
Yeah, that's possible. So, that might have been Unforgiven.
When you have a singles match in Hell in a Cell, right? You got a 20 by 20 ring. You got a cage that's 25 by 25 that goes 20 feet in the air. It's a lot of square footage to play with. So, multi-man, I think it's perfect.
And it's easy to book, particularly when you've got six guys who know what they're doing. You don't have to really go crazy. It's like, all
right,
guys.
Everybody's safe, but we're just building to the one bump. The biggest thing with that bump is you just have to trust it. If you short it, I remember the conversation, if you short the bump, if you squeeze in, you're going to be in trouble. If you trust it and just do it, you'll be fine.
Man, how much work went into playing that thing as far as measuring and setting up the truck in the exact spot?
I don't think very much.
Okay, that doesn't make me feel much better. But
if he lands, if he's here, we need to be here. You know, if he decides to become Greg Louganis, doing a 2.5 off this deal, then we're in trouble. Or if he gets, timid and lead-asses it and falls straight down, then we're in trouble, too. But if he just goes out like he should and just fall back nicey-nice, then everything will be fine. And he nailed it.
And you are right. The match is great. I mean, we talked about it Monday night, and we went through the year, and we think it's top three. I mean, it's up there with, I think, just below Triple H and Cactus Jack in the street fight. And what was the other one we said? Maybe the Iron Man?
Yeah, the Iron Man at Judgment Day.
I can't think of any other better than it that year.
What about the three-way with when Kurt got KO'd?
No, I don't think it was as good as these three.
No?
No.
That one gets remembered because it was a great job by Triple H and Rock to audible. And I think it ended up being better than it could, than it probably should have been with that kind of situation where, you know, a main guy, who knows how the rest of the show was supposed to be booked. Although we've been, didn't JR, you and I kind of talk about it, that vault about how if that was legit, and we're not saying it wasn't, but it seems like how did the rest of the show go? What do you think of this, Kev?
We talked about that earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it just still seems weird that he legitimately fell. I don't know. It just seems weird. But they did.
He legit got KO'd.
Yeah, but it seems like the end part with him coming back out, Stephanie pushing him out. I guess that was all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a shoot.
Yeah, but I think that's what I think that match is remembered. I wouldn't put that in top five for the year. But I think that's remembered for the great audible that Rock and Triple H called. And they went on for like another, 11-12 minutes of winging it. Thank God it was the two of them because they had already wrestled, four times that year, both on pay-per-view and on Raw. So if it was like somebody with no chemistry, that match could have been a shit show.
And Earl Hebner is the referee.
Yeah.
Made another stellar performance by him.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of – I thought that, again, that six-way in the Hell in a Cell, at or near the top of the list, and I include, the other matches in there as well. I'm not as high on the Triple H Foley thing, for the things that we talked about, just because the finish was so contrived. Mm. See, the contrived finish in that deal, it bothered me a lot more than the contrived finish in the – Hell in a Cell.
Well, no, we're talking about the... Well, are you talking about the cell for... Well, I was talking about the street fight at the Rumble for Cactus and Triple H, not the cell.
Yeah, the street fight.
Oh, that was... Okay, I'm thinking that was December, but no, that was January. That was the first month of the year. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's at the top of the list.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, this one's definitely up there. All right, Kev, one last question for you before we wrap. There were rumors at this time that WCW was going up for sale. And one of those rumors, I believe it was around October, was that Vince was going to buy the whole shebang. And then they ended up not following through on the deal. He backed out for whatever reason. I think it had to do with, was it the TV? It was the reason at that time? There was definitely something tied to it that made him kind of gun-shy and back off. Was there more to it than that? Do you remember that story at the time?
No, and I never heard anything about Vince buying WCW until he bought WCW.
Hmm.
It was very hush-hush around us. We didn't know of it until that, whatever the day that was, March 26th or whatever that was.
Yeah. It was like the week before, like the 24th. It probably wasn't as cheap as he...
No, there was something too. I think it's in that Death of WCW book, the one that came out like 10 years ago now.
It's a good book.
Yeah, there was more. There was something too. Vince was definitely looking to buy. There were rumors that he may get involved like in October. And then... I think it's because it was more. It was all the contracts were still involved. It was just, it would have been more hefty of a price, and he figured it wasn't worth it. And then I think it's only when it got stripped down to, we can talk about this next time you're on, but when it got stripped down to just the tape library and a few cheap contracts, that's when he thought it was worth it.
Mm. Well, yeah, because he got the whole deal for $2 million.
Right. And I bet you in the fall, it wasn't $2 million yet.
Huh?
I bet you in October it wasn't $2 million or four.
Oh,
I think it was
sure,
like three and a half or four.
No, it's probably way more than that. I think it had all the big money deals still. I think it was like the full. He would have been buying like how it was at that time, not the stripped down version.
And think about this. You know, he had seen Jim Crockett buy his time slot on George. You know, the George Championship Wrestling time slot for $1 million that financed WrestleMania. Right, and then he saw Jim Crockett pay $3 million or whatever it was for the dying UWF territory when he should have let it fail and picked it up for pennies. So maybe he hearkened back to those days and knew it was time, you know, to sit out and let it virtually crumble and then pick it up at the end, knowing that nobody else was going to be able to come in and do the deal they wanted anyway, because nobody else had the financing. And he didn't care about the TV. He didn't care about the time slots.
That would have been something. Imagine if he owned them and they sell the time slots on TBS and TNT and he was doing both.
That would have been ridiculous.
I'm out of control. All right, Kev, that was another great trip down memory lane through the rest of 2000. And we're hitting some pretty heady territory next time you're on with us as we do the first half of 2001. We may have to break 2001 into like seven parts because there's so much going on in the first half there. So that is it for this week's episode, Scott. Another great one in the books. And, of course, you guys can all check out Kevin as the voice of Ring of Honor. And if you need any marmalade or other preserves, he's available at Twitter at RealKevinKelly. And we'll be seeing you, Kevin, in January. And enjoy your trips on the road and enjoy the great work at Ring of Honor that you always provide us.
Thanks, and we're going to try. I want to see if maybe we could set up some sort of contest to give away a couple of tickets for this Pittsburgh event.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely.
Cool.
Maybe
we could do like a Royal Rumble-themed show, and we can give a couple of tickets away for our Ring of Honor event the night before. I think it's going to be... it's going to be one of the biggest events that we've ever put on. We've got a lot of big plans for it, so it's going to be very exciting. I want everybody to be a part of it, so maybe we could do something where we give away a couple of tickets.
Awesome. I think that is a great idea. Maybe we'll have 30 people come on, and whoever makes fun of Scott the best wins the ticket. All right, Scott.
Random luck of the draw.
Yeah, we could do that as well. We got some time to come up with something. All right, Scott, we will be back next Monday. We have Rumble 2001. Aaron George will be with us to help review that. And then Wednesday night, we have Headlines. We're going to review Bound for Glory, the big TNA pay-per-view with Nate Milton and Greg Phillips, and also preview Hell in a Cell. And then after that, it's our Halloween Spectacular, so it's always something to look forward to. Yep. So for Scott and Kevin Kelly, I'm Justin. We'll talk to you next week. Everyone have a great disease-free, happy, healthy weekend. We'll talk to you Monday night. Take care. Kevin, you should come on trick-or-treating in the Halloween Spectacular.
Okay.
Oreos and trick-or-treating.
And respect the code. Yes. That's my favorite line of your review.
I'm glad you like it. Still reading
it,
huh?
I really like it. Respect the code.
Whoever makes me a Tara Rising robe gets two tickets to the Ring of Honor show.
Oh, my God.
Two tickets to paradise. Well, if they make you a robe, they're going to go backstage. They're going to... whatever, wrestle Adam Cole and
win the title and
a lot to do. Oneness is clear above the dean. Proud Ariane, one word my will to sustain. For me, the claws once more to spin. Oh, all of my love, all of my love, oh, all of my love. My love.
Yours is the cloth, mine is the hat.